Hello and welcome to the Tottenham Way podcast, episode 2 of the Crisis Tapes series, the second of our specials to hopefully provide some escapism from current global events. Joining me as ever, Mr. Dan Kilpatrick. Hello, sir.
Hello, Tom.
How are things in Dan Kilpatrick land?
Things in my land are absolutely fine. Spurs, as I'm sure we'll come on to, are keeping me fairly busy on the work front. I'm trying to pick up a few other bits as well from kind of other London teams and other Premier League footballs. So, yeah, plenty to do. And I'm kind of doing my government approved exercise daily, keeping that up. So, yeah, I can't complain, mate.
It's amazing how much Spurs can keep you busy even when there's no football around, isn't it? This week, we are delighted to welcome writer and public historian Greg Jenner as well. Welcome, Greg. Thank you very much for your time this evening. How are you and how are you coping with the current weirdness?
Yeah, weirdness is the word. I'm all right. I'm sort of cycling through extreme emotions. Sometimes I wake up and go, oh, it's a lovely blue sky day. I've got a lovely baby at home who's very cute, and every day she wakes up smiling, and that's nice. And then you switch on the news and just go, oh my God, it's terrifying. So I kind of pinball between those two emotions, really. So yeah, a bit weird, but I'm okay. I've not had coronavirus. No one in my family has had it yet, so we're hopefully keeping safe.
Yeah, keeping everything crossed. Do you miss Spurs at all? I mean, that's probably not the most, it's not top of everyone's list currently, but I do find that Dan and I spoke last week and said that it is an escapism for people. And I said that how I missed Burnley Newcastle was a terrible Sunday afternoon game. But, you know, Spurs, is it something that's high enough on your list to miss at the moment, or are you quite happy without?
No, well, I mean, I'm definitely missing the rhythms of football. Definitely, you know, Saturday afternoon, I sort of stare at my phone going, what's happening? There's nothing on. I'm not missing current Spurs, because we were sort of increasingly awful, and it was starting to get to the point where I was dreading watching games. But I do miss I miss that rhythm of knowing that you've got a game coming up and feeling the optimism and the hope, and then probably looking at the team sheet and thinking, actually, we're not going to win this, and then sort of trying to get through the emotional turmoil of knowing that there's probably another 2-3 years of Jose football that, you know, regardless of whether you think he's a successful manager, I don't think anyone thinks he's a sort of flair football kind of doyen. He's not the great entertainer. So
yeah,
on, tough times.
Not a lot of staying power, I suppose, either as well. I mean, we're going to get on to Mourinho in a bit, because there's been some news in the last half hour, which I think we can't possibly skip over. But before we do that, Greg, where do you think you would place yourself on a list of well-known Spurs fans? And before you answer, the list is quite something. According to, there's a website called topspurs.com. And fittingly, it looks as if it was built in about 1952. Your competition for that title, if you like, would include Stephen Mangan, Simon Mayo, Matthew Horn, Richard Littlejohn. Oddly, the Prime Minister of Sweden, but no actual name's been given on the website there. So I don't know if it's some sort of prerequisite to be a Spurs fan to get the job.
Ceremonial thing, yeah.
Possibly, yeah. It's similarly the King of Norway, again, no actual name. and finally, Sid Owen. I mean, you've got to certainly feel like you sit above EastEnders Ricky, but where do you see yourself fitting into that list?
I don't know. You don't want to go toe-to-toe with Sid Owen. I'm imagining I am not even on the list, because no one knows who I am except my mum. I'm not remotely prominent, other than I work on a relatively famous kids show and I host a BBC podcast. But, you know, I can happily walk down the street without people trying to say hello. So I'm going to say I'm probably beneath Sid Owen, maybe slightly higher than the King of Norway's butler. And that's probably where I put myself.
Do we know it's the current King of Norway and the current Prime Minister of Sweden? Or does it just say Prime Minister of Sweden?
Yeah, I was going to say, there's no name attached to it. It's the oddest list of names I've ever seen in my life. There's a list of people that have sadly passed on as well, which is just, it's just a very odd list of names that I've seen. Some of them, he adds a little, he or she, whoever builds the website, adds a little comment next to it as well. And some of them are quite unpleasant,
well,
really.
let's make it our mission to get Greg on that list, on that website.
And, I like it. Yeah.
And let's ask any listeners, if you do know any famous Spurs fans or well-known Spurs fans that aren't on the topspurs.com list, please do write in, tweet us, let us know if anyone prominent's missing.
Jim
apart
and
from
Matt,
Greg.
you mean Jim and Matt from the Horrible Histories original team and from Ghosts. They're both Spurs fans. So Jim Howick, Matt Bainton, and both love Spurs, both go to a lot of games, and they're definitely more famous than I am. So I'm already losing to two other Horrible Histories people.
If the makers of Top Spurs website are still alive and listening, sure. Then take note.
What we'll do is we'll get Greg on that list, but we will put him, as you requested, just above Sid Owen, because I think that's fitting. So, brilliant. Okay, I mean, we're going to talk about your new book, Greg, soon, but as I say, there has been some breaking news in the last half an hour. Dan, you've tweeted it, and I think, Greg, both you and I have both retweeted it or quote-tweeted it with some incredulity. Dan, is that a word? Both of you, is that a word? I'm going to be...
It's definitely a word, Yeah, it seems fairly straightforward. It was Mourinho, Sanchez, and Ndombele, and Sessegnon were pictured on Hadley Common in Barnet. Quite amusing that Mourinho was in full Spurs training kit as well. It wasn't exactly any attempt to go incognito at all. Kind of in character for Mourinho, who's, you know, we know is someone that loves being on the training pitch, given that he lived in a hotel in Manchester and seems to quite enjoy it for the best part of 2 years, doesn't particularly enjoy being at home, we can guess or imagine. So I don't know, you know, whether we've kind of heard the last of it or whether it's a story that might kind of rumble on, as you suggest.
Yeah, I mean, we've had about 24 hours of news in which the Prime Minister has been taken to hospital with incredibly serious, you know, coronavirus. And we all know how dangerous it is, how we have to all be indoors to protect each other, to protect ourselves, to look after, you know, the fate of people in this country who might not be very well. They might have immunocompromised systems, but also just a lot of people out there who might not think that they're poorly or likely to get it, and then they might get it. So you've just got to keep your distance. And if you have to go out, you've got to keep your 2 meters. You can't just go jogging in the park or whatever. I mean, obviously, elite athletes are going to find it weird being at home all day long. They're you know, they're like greyhounds. They love running. That's all they do. But it's mad that we've encountered this today, of all days, and they're wearing the training kit and they're doing it in public. And it's like, well, what do you expect to happen? It's just really disappointing. It's really, I mean, the Spurs have had a really bad week from a PR point of view anyway, with the whole furloughing of staff and the announcing of record profits while everyone has been made, you know, pushed down onto a lower salary. But for this now to be the sort of icing on that horrible cake is really, really disappointing. And there's nothing you can say to defend it. It's just a really stupid thing.
It feels like such an unavoidable situation as well. Dan, you say that, well, you've both said there that, you know, athletes are different breeds, really. They need to be out. They need to be working on their fitness. This is a situation as unique to them as it is to anybody else. But they are perfectly set up at home to keep their fitness. I can't imagine they were going to the park and practicing penalties or, you know, they're crossing or anything. They're going there for fitness by the looks of things. There's no equipment. They're just they're having this run around, and you just can't tell me that there's no way they could do the exact same exercises at home. Spurs have, on their socials, have been pushing that about all the videos of the fitness coaches working with them and, you know, doing the Zoom meetings and stuff. It just, you mean, do look, wonder where we go from here.
Footballers are, as you said, they are used to routine, as are many professions and you know, people in many walks of life, but that footballers are particularly reliant on routine. And you know, there is potentially after this crisis is over, a different kind of crisis, you know, a mental health crisis for the entire population, I think. And footballers, you know, will not be immune from that given their way of life. At the same time, footballers are, you know, as we've heard over the last few weeks endlessly, you know, in a very privileged position. They, most of them have gyms at home or plenty of space, so there's really no reason they need to be doing this.
It's not the last we've heard of it, put it that way. Certainly not. So, Greg, you have a book on out at the moment. Was it 2 weeks ago that it came out, I think?
Yeah.
So it's still very early days.
It is, although it's not a great time to have a book out, I can tell you.
Well, this was going to be one of my questions. We say Dead Famous, An Unexpected History of Celebrity from Bronze Age to Silver Screen. Talking quite a wide spectrum there, especially of time. I heard that it took you 4 years to write, which I can imagine, considering the subject matter. But yeah, is it the worst time to bring out a book like this, when you think people are likely to be at home. You're sitting in front of a bookcase yourself. That seems to be the decor of choice for everybody who's going on Skype meetings at the moment. But is it the worst time? Is there an angle on this that you could say it's kind of an ideal time? Or am I just being a little bit idealistic there?
I think we in the publishing industry were optimistic about 2 weeks ago. I think a lot of people were like, hey, look, everyone's going to be at home. It'll be lovely. They'll run out of things to watch on Netflix and they'll start to look for books. And that was the hope. But sales last week were like diabolical across the publishing industry because all the bookshops closed. They just, Waterstones, but all the independents, the publishers send their books out through independent suppliers. So that just massively fell away. So it's been a weird couple of weeks. But, ultimately, there are much more important things happening out there. And I was just, I spent the morning kind of going, oh, no. But then you just adapt and go, all right, that's the new reality. We've just got to look after each other and crack on. And with a bit of luck, the book will do all right on audiobook maybe or ebook. You can get it on audiobook as well. And maybe it'll do better that way. So people can listen to it without having to buy it physically from a shop. But it's obviously we're now living in a kind of weird time where a lot of us are still working from home. A lot of us are still got, maybe you've got kids at home that you've got to homeschool and they're running around. But at the same time, there's also this downtime and this weird, endless sort of, gardening leave type thing where people are sitting there going, what do I do? And I think a lot of people are feeling a bit cooped up and a bit freaked out. And a lot of people I've seen are reading novels and they're trying to distract themselves. They're trying to take their brains away from what's going on in the news. So they're not reading necessarily history books, but they might be reading lovely books, novels and classic fantasy novels and stuff like that takes them to somewhere else. But
let me just jump in there and say I'm trying to read Lord of the Rings, having meant to read it for a long time.
Exactly.
I've done so many hours and the hobbits have still not got to Rivendell. It's really dragging on. The amount of songs they keep singing is just doing my head in. They're constantly breaking into song. I've actually just started skipping the songs because I don't think they're at all crucial to the plot. But yeah, I'm.
Who knows?
I'm kind of enjoying it, but I've having to have like other books on the go at the same time because I just can't solely focus on Lord of the Rings. It's too much.
Yeah, I think people are reading lots of classics they've never quite got around to. I've seen a lot of people talking about sort of getting, Middlemarch out and Jane Austen. And I've even seen someone getting out Ulysses by James Joyce, which is a real
hard work.
You really want to pick a book to distract you. I guess that might be kind of distracting. But it's an interesting time. But realistically, I guess people are looking for distractions and new ideas and so forth. And I'm hopeful that people will read the book in their own time. And it took 4 years to write, so it's bad luck that it's come out exactly as the kind of world has stopped. But you just can't get grumpy about it because there's so many bigger things out there right now. There are people who are really poorly. There are people who've lost their jobs. There are people dying. These things really matter. My book doesn't really matter. So,
In fairness, a hell of a subject matter. It's not the sort of thing that is, only relevant now. We're looking at a very long period of time that you're speaking about in this book. And do you want to give us just a bit of an idea of what it's about? So I've heard you on a podcast the other day. Dan, remind me of the name because you sent it to me the other day. The Bunker. Thank you. And you were talking quite in depth there about what it's about and what celebrity means and what it maybe isn't quite what we think it is on first hearing the word, if you like. So do you want to give us a bit of a rundown about what it is?
Yeah, so it's a history book, but it's hopefully quite funny and lively. I work on a comedy show, I host a comedy podcast, so I try and write with a bit of humor. But I am a historian, so it's a history of where does celebrity come from, how does it evolve, how does it emerge, how is it changing. I start essentially in the 1700s. That's when I think celebrity is born. So it's about 300 years old. And in terms of what is a celebrity, well, weirdly, the bizarre thing is that when I started writing it, I assumed that would be the easy bit. There isn't actually an accepted definition of what celebrity is amongst sociologists and scholars. There are lots of really good working definitions that they sort of overlap and you can kind of go, yeah, that's right ballpark. But no one's really written a definition that everyone else has gone, yeah, that's it. Nail on the head. So I had to come up with my own. And so for me, a celebrity has to tick five boxes and they're quite tricky to tick. So you've got to have a unique personality. You've got to be something distinctively you. You've got to be famous to strangers or notable to strangers. So people you've never met need to know who you are. You need to have your private life disseminated through the mass media. You need to have your private life as an object of fascination. So people need to care about not just what you do as a, like a professional job, but also about who you're dating, who you're sleeping with, what you get up to in your holidays, that kind of stuff. And there's a really crucial thing as well, which is that celebrity is when other people can make money from your fame. So not just yourself making money from it, but someone else, newspaper journalists, bloggers, photographers, paparazzi, they can also make money from your fame. So you've got to tick all five boxes for me to say you're a celebrity. So it, what that means is that there are people out there who are really famous, really, really well known, like Sir David Attenborough, who I don't think is a celebrity because we don't know anything about his love life or his family life or, you know, where he holidays. You've never seen him in his swimwear, reclining on the, you know, by the beach with a Mai Tai cocktail, whatever. I don't know anything about him. I don't know if he's married. I don't know if he's got kids, but he's extraordinarily famous and beloved. You know, he spoke at Glastonbury last year, 80,000 people cheered his name, but there isn't that private life element there. So but for
just
me,
to
that's
to challenge that, sorry, Greg, couldn't we, if I went on Wikipedia, couldn't I find that out relatively easily about David Attenborough?
Yeah, maybe you could.
I mean, presumably it's on there. I mean, are you saying that it's just his private life wouldn't make a story in a newspaper, so therefore he's not a celebrity?
Precisely, yeah. I mean, there's if newspapers aren't running this story, they don't necessarily think that there's interest in it. So what David Attenborough has is what's called renown, and renown is where you're known for what you do but not who you are. So you can be a renowned human rights lawyer, a renowned you can be a renowned artist, a renowned footballer, you can be a renowned journalist. You know, there are renowned journalists who are I'm looking at two of them right now, but renown is not the same as celebrity. Celebrity is where there is a commercial economy attached to it, but there's also a sense that you're brand, your story is treated as a human soap opera. Celebrity is when people pay money to it's basically voyeuristic capitalism. We pay money to gaze into people's private lives, and they either let that happen or they try and fight it. And we, you know, some celebrities really hate being famous, some obviously court it and enjoy it and chase it. But celebrity is an economic system. It's an industrialized form of voyeuristic capitalism, and it's been going for about 300 years. So the book is funny and lively, but it's, you know, it's got some big ideas in it too.
I mean, the best example, of course, being Sid Owen, as we've already said. it's an incredibly broad. Sorry, Dan. I was
just going to say that brings us very nicely onto footballers, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Really. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say the Amazon write-up on this was interesting, I found. And Greg, you might actually be able to tell me if this is the blurb for the book itself, but it says their celebrities could be heroes or villains, warriors or murderers, brilliant talents or fraudsters with a flair for fibbing, trendsetters, willful provocateurs, or tragic victims marketed as freaks of nature. I mean, there are at least six of those things that really jump out at me that are applied to footballers constantly. Heroes and villains, brilliant talents, fraudsters, willful provocateurs, and tragic victims. I mean, you could probably name that for everybody. Almost all of those apply to Mourinho, apart from the hero side of things. And even then, there is that kind of narrative behind him of that. So did the kind of culture of footballers, did that influence any part of the book, or is it covered at all in the book? Obviously, it's only applicable to the last probably 50 years maybe of the 300 year spell that you were talking about, but
slightly later than 50 even, actually. I mean, George Best is probably your first celebrity footballer in the English game. There's a bit in the book, there's a chapter on the economics of celebrity. So how do you, the money of it, the cash of it, like sponsorship deals and big money earnings and all that stuff. And I talk about Neymar and his transfer from Barcelona to PSG, and the fact that it cost £500 million, the transfer didn't, but there was all this ancillary stuff that happened in there. And the fact that Neymar is a micro economy, he's his own economy. And the reason PSG bought him isn't that he's not, you know, he's not just a great footballer, which he is, although obviously he spends a lot of his time rolling on the floor, but he is this commercial economy who brings eyeballs. He brings people who are watching in South America primarily, but also in China and in Singapore and in North America and obviously Germany, Norway, wherever. And so what he brings is eyeballs and eyeballs get monetized. And so PSG bought a celebrity footballer in the hope that it would drive the economics of their game. It would, you know, promote them as a brand. It would be an international thing. Obviously, they wanted him to be a star player on the pitch. And of course, he has been, in most parts, he's been successful for them. He hasn't quite won them the big trophies that they really want to win, but he's obviously, you know, tearing it up when he needs to. But he was acquired because of his celebrity. And what's interesting is I measure the kind of the income that he has. He earns £41 million a year, and before bonuses. But I measure that against a Roman charioteer from 2,000 years ago called Gaius Apuleius Diocles. And Diocles' earnings in modern money are about £15 billion. So it's absolutely astonishing. So he's not the highest paid, you know, sports person. And so you get this kind of, on the one hand, football as a massive money super industry is really, really modern. It's 25 years old, if that. And yet, actually, ironically, you could see that there was huge money in ancient sport back in Rome and Greece, but they weren't quite celebrities. They were something called fame, which is a bit different. So I do talk about sporting celebrity, but my main kind of points on it are that actually most of the sports people of the 19th century didn't earn good money. You know, they earned a bit, they earned enough, they had glamour, but they often retired pretty poor and died in poverty, or, you know, they developed alcoholism or whatever, and they after their career had blossomed, they weren't really, you know, living it large. And you get really the first major star who earns huge money in sport would be W.G. Grace, the cricketer, and he did sponsorship deals. He was the face of Coleman's mustard, which is pretty weird. presumably he got it all over his beard. And he also did sponsored deals for cricket bats. He was the face of a thing called the Magic Bat, which was a cricket bat with springs in it. This is in the 1890s, so he is this titan.
I was going to say, he could not be more Victorian in my mind. So no. The fact that he did sponsorship deals is really interesting.
But he earned a huge amount of money, and he was a gentleman amateur, so he wasn't meant to earn money at all. You know, he was meant to be earning a tiny amount. So all the money he earns was sort of under the table, brown envelope kind of situation, because he was meant to be, he was a suburban doctor. He was a GP who was also the world's most famous cricketer. And so he was not meant to earn a professional salary. But whenever he played, ticket sales doubled in price to see him. People paid money to watch him. Famously, he was bowled out and he refused to leave the crease because he said, you know, people have come to see me bat, not you bowl. So, you know, he knew his own value. But he did sponsorship deals 130 years ago. And then you get Babe Ruth in the 1920s, who was the baseball superstar in the States. And Babe Ruth had a brilliant agent. And his agent invented the phrase ghostwriting. And his agent was this guy who was just brilliant at placing stories in newspapers and hiring journalists to write things on behalf of Babe Ruth. And Babe Ruth ended up doing sponsorship deals for underpants. There were Babe Ruth pants you could wear. He had Babe Ruth chocolate bars, Babe Ruth stickers, Babe Ruth T-shirts, the lot. So sporting celebrity has been lucrative for certain superstars for about 150 years, maybe at the max, unless you want to go all the way back to ancient Rome. If you're really, really traveling, then you can do that too. But the modern game, modern football, you know, Peter Shilton was probably on what, four times the average salary at the peak of his career back in the late 70s, 80s. I mean, you know, that good money for a guy who, you know, was probably not a particularly, you know, when he was raised as a kid, he probably wasn't expecting to earn that kind of money. But at the time, he was on four to five times the national salary. And now you look at the wages of someone like, you know, Paul Pogba, or, you know, I don't know what Harry Kane's on exactly, but it's obviously probably 100 grand a week plus bonuses at least. That's huge money compared to. Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, Harry Kane is probably, you know, obviously the Spurs system is a lot more elaborate than other teams maybe, but he's on enormous money. So that's a byproduct of the fact that football is a global game and that there is a massive appetite for it. And we all pay a huge amount to watch it. So not just when we go and see a game in the stadium, you know, which is what, 50, 60 quid if you're for a big night out, and your pint and your pie and your crisps and the cheese room that never happened. And then you've also got But of course, we're also paying 40, 50 quid a month for Sky Sports, and you're paying 50 quid for your referee shirt.
You mentioned Harry Kane's salary there. I think that brings us quite nicely onto the kind of topic of the week or the month, if you like.
Yeah.
And the wage cut row and why and how footballers have seemingly become this lightning rod for public discontent. And you know, is there anything that you see in footballing celebrity that's contributed to this public feeling?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one. This is not a new thing, and it's not specifically just to football either. So in the 19th century, we got this a lot with singers and actors. There was a real thing, particularly for female performers in the 1800s, for working class performers or low status performers to be really attacked for earning too much money for their talent. And even if they were really talented, you know, amazing singers or great performers, people were really upset at the idea of these people raking in huge amounts of money. Often they were attacked as being unchristian and, you know, selfish, and that they should be giving some of this money back, or that they weren't deserving of it. So you get people like Anna Held, who was a big she was Polish-French, and she was a big star singer in America in the late 1890s and so forth, early 1900s, and she was often attacked for earning too much and, you know, not deserving it. And so that's a kind of long-standing trope. It goes back to the 1700s. There was a very famous castrato called Farinelli. He had the greatest voice of the 18th century. He was castrated as a boy, and it gave him this incredible high-pitched power. He sort of sung like Mariah Carey, but a sort of male version, you know, with deeper, more powerful voice. And he came to Britain, toured Britain, and earned a lot of money here. And he was attacked for the money he earned. So there is a long-standing tradition, actually, of singling out people that we ordinarily we love, and we pay a lot of money to go see them on a Tuesday, and we idolize them, and we put posters on the wall, and we, you know, we put their name on the back of our shirts, and we love them. But come Thursday, we are getting huffy because they earn way more than a nurse, or they earn way more than us, you know, or they're some, you know, there'll be some metric published in the papers, you know, the Evening Standard will say so-and-so has got a new contract, you know, and it's 200 grand a week plus bonuses. And you then sort of see, you know, a nurse is on 22 grand a year or whatever. And in the era of coronavirus, where we're all feeling really, well, you know, we're feeling nervous and anxious and scared, but also we're seeing doctors and nurses and healthcare workers and NHS staff literally putting their lives on the line. And we know how underpaid a lot of them are and how hard they're working. We've sort of seen this tension kicking in where the entertainment industry that we ordinarily love every Saturday actually is starting to feel, for some people, like it's not deserving of that kind of capital and that kind of cash. And so there is now this backlash. And the argument is that, well, you know, footballers earn silly money. They should be doing more for their communities. They should be doing more to support their clubs and their co-workers who might not be, you know, on the big money. And that they should also be bailing out the NHS. And so there's a kind of, I can see the logic to it, and I can see why people are saying that, because we're all tense and we're all upset. But it's a weird kind of, feels like a kind of emotional response to the situation, because most of the time we know the deal. We know that Wayne Rooney was on massive money at United. We know what Lionel Messi is getting. We're not surprised by that, because that's the value of their genius. That's what people around the world will pay to enjoy their ability on a football pitch. And we know what it costs.
Is there also an element of people consider a footballer's lifestyle to be almost too lavish, considering what work, in inverted commas, they are expected to do? You know, sort of fulfilling every football fan childhood dream, etc. Does that play into this idea of, well, they're not doing anything now, and a kind of, because there is an ongoing attitude, if you like, of footballers should, it always tends to happen if they're not, I don't know, they're on a bad run of form, you know, why should they be earning X, Y, Z? And then it's you know, it's a bit of a joke, and I don't mean it to sound as if I'm sort of parroting that, but this give soldiers footballers wages attitude that is often, and it does feel as if there is an easy target element of it. And I have to admit, I don't know how I feel about this. I don't think I've got the energy to really think about what all of the ins and outs of it are. But I guess that I think that one of the questions really is, are they being singled out because of, and where I mentioned there about those words that sort of jump out of me, the blurb of your book, you know, brilliant talents, heroes and villains, fraudsters, provocateurs, tragic victims. It kind of covers that whole spectrum of what celebrity might be, or a definition of it. But they feel like quite an easy target because maybe people consider them almost too much in the limelight. You know, hard to say. I think the biggest argument people are saying is, why are other wealthy people not being brought up and put into the same column inches? Why are they not being asked to do things when they earn similar or huge amounts? And is it just a case of footballers are accessible and there? And maybe with the introduction of them being on social media, constantly doing, you know, daily stories and pictures and things, people do have more of a window into their life. And they are more recognisable as people rather than just footballers or athletes, certainly. Mm-hmm. Does that maybe play into it? Dan, sorry, I cut you off there.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I think there's an element of the fact that in many cases, that, you know, it's kind of young working class guys who maybe aren't particularly bright or educated in some cases, although that's perhaps an unfair stereotype. And people, at times like this, people do kind of resent the fact that they're living the life. You know, they are social distancing and they're, you know, incredibly nice houses with their own gyms, and people are kind of stuck at home. So I think there's definitely a resentment element, isn't there? Like, that's almost just the human nature. But I think, I mean, did this Castrati, Greg, did he have a kind of Gordon Taylor figure? Was there a union of Castratis that were kind of pulling the strings behind the scenes? Because, I mean, that's obviously not helped things in the present row. I mean, I think although, you know, ultimately, Gordon Taylor is a union boss doing the best for his members, like, you know, many other union bosses who we should respect. I think that union has got far too powerful and slightly lost sight of reality in a way. And I don't think they quite realise how bad some of the things they're saying look. And it's not done the players, who in many cases want to help and are willing to help, any favours.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting... You know, you've both made really interesting points there. I think what we have to bear in mind is that probably, I imagine, behind the scenes, quite a lot of footballers were already thinking, how can I help? How can I be, you know, how can I donate some of my wages? How can I be supportive? But once the PFA got involved and presumably was trying to, you know, produce a standardised rubric across the entire league, then it got complicated. Because I think, I mean, as I understand it, there have been talks, I think, from... I think the Liverpool captain has been talking about, you know, taking money off of all of his players at Liverpool and giving that to the local hospital, or but also, you know, supporting the wages of the people at Liverpool Football Club. I think the working class thing is a huge issue. You know, when was the last time that we had a kind of middle class footballer in the Premier League? You know, it's Graham Lasso is the classic joke, isn't it? But these lads are overwhelmingly going to be, you know, with the exception perhaps some of the overseas players who've come over here and are perhaps had a different education system. A lot of the lads that we see at Spurs, that we see at all the major clubs, have grown up playing football, and it's not given them a huge amount of time for secondary education or other education or, you know, degrees and so forth. So there is a class element to it, but there's also this sense that, yeah, all they do is kick a ball of wind around. You know, there's that kind of... the understanding that their job involves 90 minutes of running about, which of course we know is not true. We know that their job is to be in extraordinary peak fitness all the time, constantly, day in, day out, never really, you know, deviating from their diet. They're not meant to be drinking. They're not meant to be going out after certain times. They're meant to be doing psychological mind, you know, developing techniques to try and build their confidence and their robustness in front of, you know, angry foreign fans who might be yelling abusive stuff at them. So they're always meant to be on the job, and they probably aren't. I'm sure they're playing an awful lot of FIFA and playing a lot of golf, but the reason they get paid enormous amount of money is they're brilliant and we love watching them, but also that life is extreme. It's an extreme life, And they also have the incredibly short careers that we hopefully don't have. You know, I hope to carry on writing books until I'm, you know, well, frankly, until I die. But footballers are lucky to get to 35 at the top flight. Mm. And that obviously means that they then have to be aware of it. And you can see with Jan Vertonghen, you know, who is barely 30. I mean, what is he, 31, 32?
He's 32.
Yeah, I mean, he's not an old guy at all. He's 5 years younger than I am, and I like to think of myself as relatively young. But the speed at which his, or that speed is the wrong word, the rate at which his body has given up on him this year, and we've seen this elite, world-class centre-back, who I love watching play, just suddenly being incapable of turning and sprinting for 20 yards, and it's been harrowing to watch. But psychologically, the pressure on him must be really intense, because he knows
it's a reminder. A reminder of who these people are, and they are people at the end of the day. So Dan, it's hard. I know it's the only news associated with Spurs at the moment, so it's quite difficult to feel like I don't want to dwell on it too much, but we talked about it last week about Levy's statement being incredibly open, kind of earnest, and talking about he was trying to sort of build this picture of we're all the same level, we're all the same when it comes to this sort of crisis, we're all the same, and we feel as if it might have been a bit of pressure being put onto the players. Do you want to put a final word against this, maybe just for now, until anything else comes out? What is the current feeling about the backlash against Spurs? Greg mentioned there about Liverpool and Liverpool captain Henderson, and Liverpool have, I think, had a U-turn as well, and that leaves us as the only club that are taking advantage of the government scheme, or take advantage is the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
Well, the only top six club, I mean, Newcastle have, and I think Bournemouth, Norwich, and possibly one other, Brighton?
Mm. No, I don't. Okay.
I don't know that for sure, but Spurs are the only kind of traditional big club, as it were, who have taken advantage of the scheme. And I think taking advantage is the right phrase entirely. I've been surprised at the strength of feeling in the backlash. Personally, I am somewhere in the middle of it, honestly. I think it's deeply concerning in some respects, but I also think we have praise Daniel Levy for the best part of 20 years for his running of the club as a business, doing things, everything you possibly can to, you know, put the financial interests of Spurs before anything else. And I don't think he would have done this unless he was genuinely worried at the club. I don't agree that it's a cynical move. And I think the scheme, you know, there are legitimate arguments about what the scheme is there for. It's a government pot of money to keep businesses, in some cases big businesses that pay a lot of tax, going, so that when this passes they can be in a position to hit the ground running again. They don't have to offload staff, and these are, in many cases, as Tottenham are, businesses that pay a hell of a lot of tax. At the same time, I think to be taking government money when you've just posted £70 million profit and revenues of three or four times that, you know, is deeply questionable. But I think Spurs, they're not going to be the only ones. Obviously, Liverpool have done it. I wouldn't be surprised if other big Premier League clubs, and I won't name names, follow in the next couple of weeks. So the picture could start to look differently. I think from my point of view, my concern really is that Spurs don't realise how bad this looks. They're thinking it's a purely business decision, but actually we're in a time of national crisis, an unprecedented time, and people will look back on this, you know, potentially. You know, Greg, as an historian, I know you don't want to look forward, but you know, people could be looking back on this in 20, 30, 50, 100 years' time, you know, the coronavirus shutdown and what that did for society in this country. And there's a danger that Spurs become that club. You know, this isn't just a thing that you can shrug off. They were always the team that, you know, took resources from the government, potentially took resources from the health service, if you like, and, you know, cut their low paid staff at a time when, you know, people are really struggling. So, yeah, I think
from a PR perspective, there's no doubt it was a very, very questionable move. From a business perspective, we don't really know, but I can understand why it happened, if that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, certainly this one is not going to be forgotten in a hurry, I think.
No, that seems to be a theme of this whole thing of people are saying they're going to be, people are going to look at companies differently. And unfortunately, Spurs, in one view, are a company. They are, that's how they can be looked at. They are a business. And there's plenty of businesses who kind of, if you like, being added to the naughty list currently. And Spurs are going to be part of that, particularly in a football sense. And people don't forget. And you kind of feel like Spurs fans won't forget as well. It is a tricky one, and I accept it's a difficult situation. I accept that we are in unprecedented times, but it felt like a very strong statement last week from Levy, yeah. And one that
the problem is
again,
one of the reasons I'm a bit cautious about commenting on it is Spurs have not really released the full detail of this decision yet. Their financial results for 2019, which was a bonkers year where they played at two different stadiums, had a freak run to the Champions League final. They don't actually tell us that much. If Spurs are in a position where they will potentially default on their debt repayments, or they could lose the stadium, or they could even, you know, be forced to make reams of staff redundant. If they're in that position, and we don't know if they are or not, then people, and they revealed that, then I think people will be a lot more understanding. We just don't know what difficulties these businesses face, and as you said, they are businesses. Mm-hmm. Football clubs are businesses that pay, you know, outlay a lot of money, mainly on player wages, which is why we're talking about it. And their revenue streams, their cash flow, literally stopped overnight. They're not really making any money, even on merchandise sales. A lot of the warehouses that ship kind of Spurs shirts and merch have shut down because of social distancing measures. So, you know, it is, they are, like many people and like many clubs, in a tough position. There are clubs in much worse positions, but I just don't know at the moment how bad it is for Tottenham.
No, I mean, I think realistically, Daniel Levy is one of, you know, Europe's best chief executives in terms of running a football club as a sleek, slimline, efficient. You know, what he's done is extraordinary. He's built a world-class stadium, and you know, it's wonderful. But you never want to be doing the same thing that Mike Ashley is doing. You know, wherever Mike Ashley leads, you should not follow. And he, you know, we're in the same boat as Newcastle, and it just feels like, oh no, that's not great.
That's a boat with a lot of holes, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly that. And we're also just aware, I suppose, that Daniel Levy's business plan was probably always rather sophisticated. You know, I imagine that there's an awful lot of thought that's gone into all the transfers, all of the appointments, all of the decisions, the firing of Pochettino, the hiring of Jose. There would have been a huge amount of risk analysis and, you know, metrics and affordabilities and amortizing debts into next year's finances and putting them five down. You know, that they've already refinanced the stadium once. And then this comes along and will ruin every single one of those calculations. So I can imagine that they are probably thinking, right, we've just got to stop the damage and see what we can do. But I think from a PR point of view, it's been a really poor week, and it's getting worse, obviously, with the whole training in a park thing. But but I guess a huge problem that a lot of people see with Daniel Levy's Tottenham is that they don't see his love for the game, they see his love for business, I think. And I guess a lot of fans feel like Spurs are a project. I've seen some people saying that, you know, Spurs are being sort of primed to be sold because all the assets are now in place. You've got your celebrity manager, you've got your world-class stadium, you've got your Harry Kane. It's ripe for some business person to come in and say, right, I'll buy that for however many billion. So maybe that's true, but... I think what we don't necessarily get from Daniel Levy is the kind of sense that he really loves this club and that he really enjoys the football of it and the fan side of it. So, it's tough.
Yeah, that's a totally fair point. I think that sums it up, really. I think that's, a lot of fans share that view. And I think, talking of easy targets, Levy is a very easy target when it comes to that. He does take a lot of flack, and he gets far more criticism, I'd say, than he does praise, and that seems to go hand in hand with the fortunes of the football or the team that's on the pitch at the time, and recently it hasn't been good. So it kind of feel like this is never a good time for something like this, of course, but it's certainly for Levy to be making these sort of decisions. But at the same time, he's a businessman, and you kind of almost have to admire the balls out approach in a way, you know, not personally maybe, but you just think he's, as Dan says, if he's doing the things that are in the best interest of the club for the next 50 years because of this, yeah, he's got foresight, or feels he's got the foresight, then perfect. We're going to finish on we talk of celebrity as a theme throughout this podcast, and I was thinking the whole time, Greg, that you were talking about your book and talking about the kind of the history of it and how it's hard to define, and I was trying to think of a Spurs player that kind of fits the bill more than anyone. Dele Alli was up there, and I think actually it was a couple of years ago we did a podcast, and Dan, you mentioned that Alli was one of the most marketable footballers in the world, I think, at the time, for a number of reasons, but Heung-min Son must be.
He was about 2 years ago, I think.
Right, okay. It's not been good a couple of years, though.
Possibly not anymore. Yeah. The boil, isn't it?
Yeah, the player that we can definitely say would certainly meet a lot of the criteria that Greg, you laid out earlier, but Heung-min Son, it looks like there's been a lot of talk again, and Dan, you might be able to put more fact to this, but Son's military service is kind of rearing its ugly head again. We all thought it had gone away after the Asia Cup that he won with South Korea that rendered him exempt. But why has this come round again? What's the story here?
So Son has to do a shortened 4-week military service, regardless of winning the Asian Games, getting exemption from the full 21-month service. So apparently, according to local media in South Korea, he's going to be joining the Marine Corps. He's going to be doing some fairly grueling exercises, including gas chamber training. I can't remember what the term is, but basically recruits have to run into this building with gas masks on and there's tear gas, and then they have to take them off and find their way out, which just frankly sounds really dangerous. hand-to-hand combat, apparently grenade throwing, firing live rounds, sleeping in a communal bed with other conscripts. And then apparently it ends with a 30-kilometer march in full combat gear, which is very, very heavy. Obviously something's definitely going to go horribly wrong because it's Son and Spurs, and they seem to both attract bad luck. But yeah, it's really interesting, I think, from a kind of celebrity point of view, given how big a star Son is in South Korea, that he's having to do this. And from what I heard, speaking to a South Korean reporter I know, people there do find it quite amusing that he's having to go through this.
Oh, poor Son. That's horrible. It's not. I thought it was going to be like a source of immense pride that he was going to be doing it. I didn't think that they would find it as funny as maybe some people here would. That's horrible. I can't imagine the poor guy's face when he's going to have to be going through grenade chucking or whatever it is.
He's the smiliest guy in the world. He'll love it. He'll find a way to make it wholesome and delightful, and everyone will have a hug midway through, and then there'll be a cute little handshake, and he'll make it. I mean, he's the nicest man in the world, so it'll be fine. Yeah.
He is celebrity, though, isn't he? When you think of all the things you said at the beginning of this, Greg, about other people can make money off him. I mean, he is his own market in South Korea completely. He is recognisable on the street. He's probably the most famous Asian player that's played in the Premier League. Maybe not the most successful. I think Jason Park probably, but
yeah, sure.
Most recognisable by quite a long way. I imagine he's somebody that fits the bill perfectly for what you're talking about. Maybe more so than anyone in the England team or English based.
Yeah, certainly in terms of the economics of it, like, you know, he's done adverts for all sorts of products. You know, there are those lovely GIFs on Twitter where you can watch him, you know, doing his fun dancing and selling various types of soda pop or whatever it is. He's highly recognizable. He's got that wonderful smile that, you know, is kind of iconic. I suppose the only thing that's missing is he just doesn't really have a kind of salacious private life, because he lives with his parents, doesn't have time for a girlfriend or boyfriend. I don't know, you know, who he fancies, but he doesn't have a love life that we're aware of, and there are no scandals with him. You know, I think the biggest scandals have been on the pitch, you know, where he's gotten involved in nasty tackles, not necessarily maliciously, but he's broken a leg, or he's been sent off a couple of times in stupid ways. And obviously he scored the first goal in the new stadium. You know, he's one of our key players in a really fascinating way. And he's also just so lovely. And I love him. I genuinely think he's just the nicest bloke. And I just really enjoy the fact that he's at Spurs, because he just seems to really like football. He seems to love being at Spurs. He seems to love what it is to be an elite athlete, and he doesn't seem to have any kind of dark side to his personality. And so kind of what's interesting about his celebrity actually is that he's squeaky clean, and most celebs aren't actually. Most of them, you know, struggle to be squeaky clean, because to be interesting, you've got to be a little bit dangerous. You know, it's going to have a bit of an edge to you. And Beckham was the kind of ultimate football icon until Cristiano Ronaldo came along. And Cristiano obviously is no longer squeaky clean at all, because, of course, there are these incredibly serious sexual assault allegations against him, which have sort of kind of gone away, but not quite. And that's really, I mean, I don't know if they'll come back and we'll see his reputation really changed. But I think what's intriguing about Son is that clearly there is money there. There is stardom there. He is a hero. You know, he's not a villain. But the question is, what happens to him if something goes a bit wrong? You know, if he goes off the boil a bit, either as a footballer or if in his personal life or private life, he does something, you know, during basic training, if he accidentally lobs a grenade into the wrong place and hurts someone. I mean, hopefully not. But like, you know, if scandal comes for him, what would happen then to his brand? Because obviously you get heroes of athletics who change their brand overnight. OJ Simpson was the most famous one. He went from being the icon, the hero, the brilliant football player who was in movies. And then suddenly you had the most incredible change of direction, and he became, you know, the most famous man in America for allegedly committing a murder, or did he, you know? And so celebrity is a very strange thing, because it can drop, it can land in your lap without you wanting it and without you expecting it. And it can also change on you. It can turn on you really, really quick. I mean, the grenade analogy actually is probably quite fitting. Celebrity can go off in your face without you expecting it. You know, it can blast shrapnel all over your life. And David Beckham, as a celebrity footballer, you know, when he was at Real Madrid, when he was in LA, there was a kind of a whole entourage. There was a whole lifestyle. There were all the magazines who chased him around. There was the fashion shoots. There was all of that stuff that wasn't football. And, you know, it's going to affect, to, you know, it probably hasn't affected Cristiano Ronaldo so much, but it will have an impact. So with great celebrity comes great not responsibility, that's Spider-Man, but comes, you know, a sort of a friction, a kind of a weight that you get added to your reputation, and that can drag you down, or it can give you ballast to drive you even further forward. You know, you can become a superstar or you can tip the other way. And Dele Alli, obviously, he's had a couple of years that haven't been great for him, and I really hope he gets back to form and fitness and is scoring goals again. It's hard for him without Harry Kane there, and he's obviously, to a certain extent, maybe he's been found out by defenders. He doesn't have raw pace, so, you know, maybe they've, centre backs have sussed out his movement. But I really hope, you know, for his sakes, for our sakes, for England's sakes, that he gets back into that fantastic form that we had him in a couple of years ago,
and stays marketable as well. I'm sure that's high up the list of, for him, his agent, for Levy, for the club, everyone. He is, as we said, 2 years ago, he was the most marketable footballer out there. So it's Greg, I feel like we could probably speak to you for 4 years it took you to do this book. I mean, I can see why. It's fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been really, really interesting. I think it's given a new angle on what's going on with Spurs. Where can we buy Dead Famous? I mentioned earlier about Amazon, and you also said about the bookshops, unfortunately, but still available. Yeah. Where can you point people to get their copy?
Sure. I mean, Amazon's obviously the normal place. Waterstones are ramping up their online shop at the moment, which is nice, and that's great. Audible is a good place. You know, if you want to, I narrate the audiobook, and it was really fun to do. If you like audiobook, you can go on Audible and listen to a little sample. If you like that, download that. That'd be great. You can get it on Kindle, hardback, audio. So wherever you can find it would be fab. But easiest place is probably Waterstones and Amazon. But, you know, some people like to support indies, and that's great.
Just had a look, and Sid Owen does indeed have a biography. So if there's a 2-for-1 deal there as well, then why not combine those things together?
What's it called?
No, Greg. I've just closed the tab, but it is out there. Not sure. Sid Owen, as yet untitled, maybe. No, Greg, thank you so much. It's been fascinating. It's been really, really nice to have you on. It's interesting times. So stay safe, keep well, and fingers crossed for the book, mate. Dan, it's been a pleasure as always. We have a few more of these specials lined up for the series. Not sure what's coming up next, but I think we're going to have a return of the quiz, which I'm very excited for. So Dan, get your revision in.
I have got a clarification to make before I go. I am now told, you may have noticed I've been slightly distracted in the last couple of moments. I'm now told that Mourinho did not arrange a training session with Ndombele, Sessegnon and Sanchez. He arranged a one-on-one session with Ndombele, and Sanchez and Sessegnon happened to be jogging together on the same common at a similar time.
Still okay.
Still not great, is it?
I'm relaying that information. If I've been quiet for the last 5 minutes, it's because I've been receiving messages on that.
This developing breaking story of,
yeah,
of Mourinho down the park. Oh, what a football club. Incredible. All right, Dan, really nice to speak to you. Greg, thank you so much again.
Cheers.
Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Like I say, we'll be back with the next episode in our Crisis Tapes series. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.